welcome to the LTC University podcast. My name is Jamie Preston, and today we're jumping into part two of our series on diabetes management with Dr. Casey McMillan from SC House Calls. If you haven't listened to part one, go back and listen to that. Dr. McMillan gives us a wealth of knowledge on diabetes and how to manage that. So we're going to jump right into part two of diabetes management with Dr. Casey McMillan. Thanks for listening. So I remember when I was, you know, first diagnosed, they put me on metformin. You know, I took that for a while. You know, it has its fun side effects, you know, and it was also, she said, you know, this can help you lose weight as well, as you alluded to earlier, you know, with that as well. But there was a point, she said, yep, we need to move to insulin. I was terrified. I was like, I do not want to have to stick a needle in my stomach every couple times a day. It's just, it took me forever to, she made me do it in the office. And she had I think it was Levemir, and she said, you know, I would need to see you do this, need you to be educated how to do this. Took me forever. It really wasn't that bad. It's worse pricking your finger to check your blood sugar than it is the actual needle for the Levemir. But how do you know as a physician when somebody needs to transition from a pill, you know, to, you know, I see what you're saying about the hospital and it's easier to control that way, but how do you know when somebody needs to transition from just taking oral medication to insulin?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. And it's extremely important. There's no one size fits all answer. Mm-hmm. Every provider is going to do things a little bit different and has to take a lot of things into account. You mentioned, of course, your initial reluctancy to doing it. Mm-hmm. That's one of the big ones we come across. Sure. People do not want to give themselves injections, and I'm sympathetic to that. But there's certain times when I just have to say, look, this is not working. This is not adequate. And so it mostly comes down to what kind of glycemic control are you achieving with what you're doing. If it's an outpatient, if you've been diagnosed with diabetes, say we diagnosed you last year with diabetes and your A1C was 10. Since I sent you away, we gave you education, we gave you a glucometer, and we brought you back in a few months. And a few months later, maybe you're 9.5. Okay, now it's time to start medicine. We're starting metformin. That's the standard starting point. You come back and, okay, now I'm 9.2 A1C 3 months later. Now, remember this. Like I said, it's a direct sliding scale between A1C and standard control of sugars. Mm-hmm. And there's a formula we can use. But an A1C of 9.2 suggests an average sugar of somewhere around 200 in the low 200s. That's not good. That's telling me that if I have a patient that's in the low 200s for more than a few years, I can rest pretty confident they're going to have a pretty serious diabetic complication mm-hmm. within 10 years.
Sure.
It's not good enough for a long term. Now, okay, 95-year-old granny who's, you know, dying of cancer. That's not who I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the, you know, standard, say, 50-year-old person who's recently diagnosed with diabetes, but theoretically has 20, 30 years of life left. That's who we're talking about. So they come back and they're 9.3 and they've tried to make dietary changes. They've tried to lose weight and it's just not working. And they're still 9.2, 9.3, 8.9. And you're not at goal yet. And we can talk about goals later. That person has basically proven that pills alone are not going to work. And I may have left out. You might have tried a second pill. You might have tried a third pill. You may have even tried one of the new injectable non-insulin therapies that are out there now. But you still have average sugars in the 200s. You still have A1Cs in the 8s. And you've maximized appropriate therapy, or you're starting to have side effects on the therapies that you're on. That's when it's time to start insulin.
Gotcha.
I try not to start it in the hospital and send them home. Sometimes it's necessary. I mean, I'm not going to say I've got a person in the hospital. I check an A1C and it's 8.5. I'm most likely not going to send them home on insulin when they leave the hospital. Even if the sugar the day they left was 190, I'm most likely not going to do it. It's just not the biggest of their concerns at that mm-hmm. point. They need to recover from their acute illness, their sure. stroke or whatever. But yeah, that person in clinic who has seen, look, I've tried everything, this is not working, that's when it's time to do. If you're not at your goal with otherwise maximal therapy or intolerable side effects, it's time to start insulin.
Yeah, I know one of the fears that a lot of people have, you know, once they start insulin, can you come off of insulin?
Sure. Yes, you can. We talked, of course, about cure and what that means. And most people who start insulin will be on insulin lifelong, but there are certainly plenty of patients who don't. The mm-hmm. most important thing for most of these patients is going to be weight loss. Sure. There's no way around it. Mm-hmm. Weight loss is going to be the way that the majority of these people are going to get off insulin. And if they don't lose the weight, they're going to be stuck on insulin, at least as long as they want to avoid long-term complications. Mm-hmm. You know, if they give up and they say, you know, I don't care if I end up on dialysis when I'm 65, okay, fine. Or they're just like, I'm not doing this. I don't want to do this. I'm not willing to do this. This is, my life is miserable because I'm having to stick myself all the time, which that's kind of a misnomer because it's not necessary in most patients. Okay, I can't help you. But if your desire is to work with me to achieve long-term good control and to most importantly do whatever it takes to lose weight and become more active and healthy, mm-hmm. yes, you can come off insulin. And we should set that as a goal. We should tell them up front, look, I'm trying this now and my goal for you is to get off of it, but here's what else you have to do and here's what we have to do together as a team in order to eventually get off insulin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's take another scenario here. So you've been hospitalized, you've been in the hospital, you've had some other issues, maybe it's stroke, whatever put you in the hospital. You've now been sent home. I know SC House Calls, a huge part of what you guys do is trying to keep people from going to the hospital, to keep people, because that's where it gets really expensive. It's sometimes not the greatest place to be. So, how do you keep them from going back to the hospital if they keep having these really sure. high elevated sugars?
Sure. Well, it's funny. I'm a hospital doctor who hates hospitals. Yeah. and I'm married to a pharmacist who hates medications.
Yeah.
And that's the outlook that we have to have because we mm-hmm. don't want people in the hospital,
right.
especially now with accountable care organizations. We're on the hook financially. If we mm-hmm. don't do a good job keeping people healthy and out of the hospital, we're going to take the hit, and sure. we can't have that. But most importantly, it's the patient, and it's how do patients – what's their quality of life like? If people are in the hospital, their quality of life stinks. When I look through these charts on people that I'm certifying for home health, what's the number one goal they say? Stay out of the hospital. Hospitals have so many complications. So many bad things happen there. People are miserable. Of course, with COVID, we learned that the social isolation can be a miserable thing. We absolutely want to keep people out of the hospital because their life is better. Mm-hmm. So, you asked, how do we do that? Well, having a good medical team in place, such as what we do with South Carolina House Calls, is critical. Mm-hmm. Nobody succeeds at diabetes on their own. Yeah. It takes a team. It takes a village. If you don't have family members who are encouraging and helping you, a social support network, I mean, if you're going out with your buddies and getting hammered on Friday night, you're not going to have glycemic control and you're going to end up back in the hospital.
Sure.
If you don't have a nurse who's constantly calling you, if you don't have a doctor who's checking your labs appropriately, making wise adjustments, if you don't have a pharmacist who's training you on the different medication options and how to best get your insulin dialed in, if you don't have a dietitian who's telling you, hey, you know what, maybe you should do a little more of this and a little less of that, maybe mm-hmm. we should keep a log of what you're doing. If you don't have those things in place, there's a high chance you're going to fail and you're going to be back in the hospital, either for the diabetes itself or because of one of the inevitable complications of diabetes, whether that's kidney disease, heart disease, or wounds, you name it. Mm-hmm. But I say that in a kind of a negative light, I assume a person's going to fail. No, I don't want them to fail. And it is quite possible to achieve success with diabetes. I tell people all the time, when I diagnose chronic illnesses, they've never been diagnosed with diabetes before. They've never been diagnosed with heart failure before. They've never been diagnosed with chronic kidney disease before. I tell them, look, this is not a disease or a condition that has to affect your life. You can live a totally healthy, normal, well-functioning, satisfactory life with this condition. Mm-hmm. Even if you're going to have it the rest of your life, it does not have to affect you. And sometimes there are cures. We don't know up front, But I can tell them, if you take, don't deny it. I mean, I have a lot of patients who are in denial about their sugars, but if you don't deny it and you accept it and say, this is where I am, this isn't the lot that I've been given here, and how can I succeed? We as a healthcare team, we can help you succeed.
Yeah.
We can give you every medicine, every education, every follow-up that you need to succeed and to stay out of the hospital. Glycemic control, of course, is extremely important. Mm-hmm. Checking your own sugars on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain patients, particularly type 2 milder diabetics with decently well-controlled A1Cs, who maybe they don't even need to check their A1Cs, check their own finger sticks on a regular basis. Most patients, though, will benefit from finger sticks. Most patients are going to benefit from regularly checking them, mm-hmm. and writing them down.
Yeah.
Keeping a logbook. There's just no substitute. I hear patients all the time tell me, oh, well, it's been pretty good. Okay, what's pretty good? Oh, well, it's mostly in the 100s and sometimes in the 200s. Like, that is the difference between I'm going to live to 100 and the difference in I'm going to be on dialysis when I'm 60. Like,
mm-hmm.
that is way too vague.
Yeah.
It's got to, and so until you take ownership of it and write this stuff down and say, to my doctor or my NP, the next time I show up in the office, hey, here's my logbook. Here's the times of days when I'm getting real good success. Here's the times of days when I'm not having good success.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I've been eating. If you provide us as providers that information, we're going to be able to give you a great plan.
Yeah.
Now, enacting the plan, that's another problem. And that leads into kind of barriers that we have mm-hmm. to help overcome as providers.
Yeah. And what you're saying is so true. Because I look back at my own journey with diabetes, when I was checking my blood sugars. Now, I didn't have the fancy things that they have on the back of their arms now. I didn't have all that stuff. That stuff was just came out a little bit later, and which would have been great. But when I was checking it on a regular basis, 3 times a day, it really helped me. It really helped me because it informed my next meal. Like it said, okay, I know I'm not going to eat this because my sugar was a little bit up, you know, so I need to watch what I eat. So the more data that you have as a patient, you know, the better, you know. And then when you go back to get that A1C, I remember after I was first diagnosed and it was my A1C, I think it was around a 10 at this point. And I had it when I went back, you know, three months later, I think I had it down to an 8. I felt great. You know, my doctor was super proud. You know, it was just a good moment, you know, to see that progress. Now, I went the other way after that, you know, unfortunately, which brings me to my next question. You know, why does it not often work? Because I was seeing some success, but then I got lazy. I got into a rut again, back to, you know, like, ah, this stinks. You know,
right.
I hate pricking myself with a finger. Why doesn't it work, you know, so often?
Right. Right. Well, you touched on a lot of things. It depends where you are in your circumstances. I mean, you know, if you're in a third world country, this probably doesn't apply to you because access to care is probably the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
In America, access doesn't tend to be as big a problem, although it certainly can be at certain times. Sometimes,
sure.
The most important one is always going to be psychological. A person's willingness to accept it, learn about it, and do what they're supposed to do. And of course, you probably know this. Healthcare providers, we're sometimes the worst. We're terrible patients. I'm a horrible patient.
Yeah,
I freely admit I am non-compliant. Is I'll get out whenever I'm given a course of something, whether it's an antibiotic or whatever. I hardly ever finish it. I'm a hypocrite.
I'm married to a pharmacist.
So it's hard. I get it because I've lived it. But the person having the desire and accepting that, oh, I really do have this, and if I don't deal with it, I'm going to have something happen that I don't like. There's just so much denial, so much just pretending it doesn't happen. Oh, no, this doesn't really apply to me. That won't happen. Oh, yeah, I know. I remember my mom had an amputation, but that won't happen to me. There is just such a barrier there, and it has to be continually encouraged and a lot of education, and hopefully some good social support from people you know with diabetes that have been there, done that, seen the bad, seen the good. So number one is going to be psychological. And there's no easy answers for that. Mm-hmm. You know, economic stuff matters. You brought up the price of insulin. That is huge. There's no way around that. The good news is there's still a lot of fairly inexpensive options out there, particularly for the majority of patients that are not on insulin, that are on pills only. There's some good old stuff. Metformin, you mentioned, is just – it's the greatest. Yeah. It is – there are some exceptions, and there's some people that don't tolerate it very well with side effects. But metformin is the cornerstone of type 2 diabetic therapy for most people, and it should remain that way. Mm-hmm. It helps people lose weight. It has very minimal side effects. It can be used in a lot of different kidney, you know, until you get really bad on kidney disease, you can continue to use it, which is not the case with a lot of meds. It's safe. It's accessible. It's cheap as dirt. That's the starting point for a good reason. But yes, insulin and some of the new branded stuff that you see advertised on TV, absolutely. It can be economics has a big thing to do with that. And there's some ways around that that probably beyond the scope of our talk, but the pharmacist can always help with having good primary care follow-up, having a doctor or nurse practitioner who's either coming to the house and helping you, calling you regularly, or you're going to their office. That's going to matter a lot. Obviously, language. If you don't understand, if you got a third grade education, you might not be able to understand things. We try to meet people where they are and keep it appropriate, but you know, diabetes is not easy. Yeah. Education definitely an issue. Language, if it's not your first disease, one thing we run into a lot of is blindness. A lot of our patients have poor vision as a result of their diabetes, and they can't pull up. They can't see the little numbers on the side of a syringe. Mm-hmm. We have ways around that, such as like using pens that click, and they can know how many units of insulin they're giving. Pill boxes. You talked about Sakulana Home RX and having boxes laid out. So it's very easy, even if you have visual difficulties. Mm-hmm. Neuropathy. A lot of people have nerve damage and can't use their fingers very well. And so it can make manipulating, devices and insulins and pills very difficult. Things like how well are they controlled before? Because sugars, you get toxic from high sugars, and it can take a while to get down. So it might take you some time to achieve good control once you've been in a real crisis state. Sure. So you have to be patient. And you have to make adjustments as necessary. And that's part of that is education, part of that's follow-up. But I always tell patients when I send them out of the hospital on, say, 15 units of Levemir, for example, I always tell them, look, this is a starting point. This is not, I'm giving you this and this is what you're going to be on for the next, 5 years. Absolutely not. In fact, if that person is still on the exact same amount of units that I chose after a 2-day hospitalization a year from now, someone's not doing their job. Because it tells me that nobody has looked at what their A1C has, looked at their glucometer logs, and seen what they really need. So that's a big barrier. One of the big things we can do to overcome barriers, though, is new technology. You mentioned the continuous glucose monitors, the things that you wear on your arms, and it connects to a smartphone and it tells you what your sugars are all the time, and you don't really have to do pricks very often. That is a wonderful tool.
Would have been a game changer for me. I would have loved that.
Insulin pumps, where a person doesn't have to give themselves insulin intermittently because it's always being given. That is more modality for either type 1s or people with really bad, very brittle, very highly labile disease, but it can be a game changer also. So there's some ways technologically of around some of the barriers. Depression, of course, is another barrier. If a person is just in a really bad place mentally, it's not very likely their sugars are going to get good controlled. Mm-hmm. If they're an alcoholic and they drink their calories, there's no way their sugars are going to get well controlled. So addressing those in whatever way is appropriate for that is certainly a big deal. Remember, a lot of your psychoactive depression or schizophrenia or bipolar type drugs, they can absolutely have an effect on sugar control as well too. So you might have to coordinate with your psychiatrist on what's going to be the best way to deal with the mental health side of things, because it affects the physical health as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest struggles for me, and it's, you know, and this is when I was in my 30s, you know, it's hard to look 10 years down the road. It's hard to look 20 years down the road and realize that this is going to be a problem. Because here's the deal. I felt fine when my sugars were at their highest. I didn't feel a difference whether they were low or high. It didn't matter. I felt just the same as I normally did. But like you said earlier, 20 years, 10 years, what, you know, what complications is this going to cause? And that's what you, that's what's hard to get through to people, I think, is that, you know, looking forward in the future.
It's easy to convince a person to do something if they feel bad. Mm-hmm. It's not nearly as easy if they feel perfectly fine.
Yeah.
That's one reason type ones. It's easy to get them to take their insulin because they're going to feel like garbage. Mm-hmm. And if they're not under good control. Type twos, usually that's not the case. Some exceptions, but most people don't really know the difference. Now, if they get low, that's another story.
Yeah,
we can talk about that in a minute as well too. But that's the really dangerous situation. But enlisting the person on taking care of themselves when they don't feel bad is extremely difficult. So education, mm-hmm. follow up. And eventually, hopefully, they will see the light before they have one of these bad complications. Because, look, once you start having diabetic complications, they're going to keep happening. Mm-hmm. Once you get that first nasty wound that takes forever to heal or takes 6 weeks of antibiotics or ends up with in the operating room, it's almost too late at that point. Yes, certainly getting sugar control then will slow down the progress of other complications, but the horse is out of the barn if you get to that point.
Sure. That is episode 2 of our series on diabetes management. We'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks so much. Thanks for listening. And if you could leave us a 5-star review, we would really appreciate it. Visit our podcast website at ltcuniversitypodcast.com. You can also subscribe to one of our other podcasts in our podcast network, The Disruptive Podcast with Scott Middleton, Experiencing Healthcare with Matt Staub, and the Thriving Practitioner Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we'll be back next week with a new episode. Have a great week.